The Obama Presidential Library is coming to Illinois to Jackson Park on Chicago's South Side. We'll talk to the Chicago Tribune's Blair Kamen, who first broke the news. Also, Tim McCarthy is a former Secret Service agent who was shot by would-be presidential assassin John Hinckley Jr.
I hope that they're right about releasing John Hinckley. And I hope that because of the damage that he did, he killed Jim Brady and he almost killed the President of the United States.
That's McCarthy speaking to the Chicago Tribune. We'll talk with him. He's now the police chief of Orland Park. And we use many different chemicals in our everyday lives, but scientists say those chemicals need more scrutiny, especially for children's sake.
Children's systems are changing and developing rapidly. And so an insult to those processes can kind of knock things out of whack.
That's scientist Asa Bradman on KQED. We'll talk with two other scientists who are also calling for tighter regulations of chemicals in everyday products. All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Children in America today are at unacceptably high risk of developing disorders that affect the brain and nervous system, including autism, ADHD, intellectual disabilities, and other learning and behavioral disabilities. This can be prevented. So said a group of nearly 40 doctors, scientists, and health advocates this month in a statement that was published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. The group, which includes the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, wanted to call attention to research that says pregnant women and children are in danger of being exposed to several chemicals that could contribute to the health conditions we just mentioned, as well as cause premature birth. They want more regulations of chemicals that are used in everyday products, whether that's in or outside our homes. We're joined now by two scientists who signed that statement. In studio with me is Sue Schantz. She's a professor of comparative biosciences at the University of Illinois. Sue, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
And on the line with us from Washington, D.C. is Jennifer Sass. She's a senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, a nonprofit international environmental advocacy group. Jennifer, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
As always, those of you who are listening are welcome to join our conversation as well. If you have questions or comments about this, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. Sue, what message were you and the others who signed this consensus statement, what were you hoping to convey to people?
We really feel like it's time for a call to action, that there are so many chemicals that children are exposed to and pregnant women that are exposed to, and the evidence is really building and becoming quite strong for a number of these chemicals that they are affecting the brain development and the neurodevelopment of our children. And so we wanted to come together as this really diverse group of experts, people doing the research, medical practitioners, public health people, child health advocacy people, and environmental advocacy and policy people to try to have a united statement and a real call to action that this is an important problem that we need to address, and we need to address it now.
Jennifer, when we say that we need to address it now, you're with the NRDC, what kind of regulations would the NRDC in particular like to see around these chemicals?
Well, there's a lot of things that different regulatory agencies could do. Some of them include from the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in terms of reining in the overuse and unnecessary use of a number of the most toxic pesticides. The Consumer Product Safety Commission also has a responsibility because of some chemicals like phthalates and plasticizers in products, especially ones that pregnant women and children may be exposed to. And then, of course, companies, retailers, wholesalers, and consumers all have a role to play in making sure that their product line is as safe as possible and that consumers demand that their products are safe.
There's several different chemicals that are mentioned in the report: lead, mercury, some pesticides, flame retardants, chemicals used in plastic. So why did the group choose to focus on chemicals in particular?
Well, that's what we do. That's our concern. The academic researchers involved in this are all environmental health experts. So it's really our passion to try to do what we can to protect children's health in terms of the negative impact that chemicals might be having on children's health. We picked the chemicals on our list as prime examples because we felt that there's compelling scientific evidence that these chemicals are, in fact, impacting children's neurodevelopment.
Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. If you have questions, you can join us. Let's go to Alita in Normal. Hi, Alita. Welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Yeah, hi. My question is about nail polishes. And they get started so early. And they're marketed a lot of these bottles and their cute little colors. But you think about them.
Alita, we're having a really hard time hearing you. Sorry, I'm not sure if you're, it sounds like you're on your cell phone, but are you, you're asking about nail polish that's marketed to children, is that correct?
Yes, and also the remover, you know, the polish remover is, you know, inhaling that, but also chewing on nails.
Okay. Do we know about, Jennifer or Sue, either of you jump in here, do we know about nail polish in particular and if there are hazards for kids when they're biting their nails?
There are a number of chemicals, plasticizer-type chemicals, in a lot of brands of nail polish, things like phthalates. But we also know that there are brands of nail polish that don't have those, and that's because consumers demanded that safer nail polishes be produced. And so that's really great. So consumers have choices, and they can make informed choices. The concern is really in the fragrance or the smelling. So it's when the nail polish is going on wet. And those are big concerns for especially women, including women who may become pregnant, who go into salons or work in salons where they're around the nail polish smell a lot.
Jennifer, how would you know if the nail polish has those chemicals? Is this listed on the bottle? To my knowledge, I don't feel like a nail polish, does it have that ingredient list?
It doesn't on the bottle. That's a good question. But I think there's different kinds of places you can go to look up, maybe try on the web, to see the brands of nail polish that are advertised as not having phthalates in them.
Phthalates, that's the chemical that you're looking for with nail polish. Our staff looks like they're looking that up right now, so we're going to get some of those resources and tweet that out for you. Again, our number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's get back to, and thanks for that call. We've got some Facebook questions we're going to go to in a minute, but I wanted to get back to phthalates is one chemical that Alita was bringing up. Susan, you have done particular research, I know, on when we're talking about chemicals, you were starting to mention some of the chemicals that have been, that you guys have focused on. And I know there's sort of, I know there's terms that scientific journalists use, but I think a lot of these chemicals have really complicated names. And I think people sometimes think if we can't pronounce the name, we don't want to be involved in a chemical like this. And so I wanted to talk about that for a minute and just how we know what chemicals in particular you guys were focused on.
So I'm not sure if you're asking about Project Tender.
Yes.
Chemicals. Okay. So yeah, we can boil that down a little and make
sure.
It a little easier for people to understand. There's a short list that we chose, as I said, just because there's compelling evidence for these. One of them is organophosphate pesticides, or we just call them OP pesticides. These are often used in agriculture on vegetables and on some fruits. So these are chemicals that you might be exposed to if you're a farm worker or if you're eating fresh fruits and vegetables. Polybrominated diphenyl ethers, which I know is a really big mouthful, those are flame retardants, and they were in the past used in a lot of different kinds of products, such as furniture, the upholstered furniture, such as carpeting, such as electronics, small electronics like computer casing and so on. So those things are in our homes. They've been phased out of use in the U.S., but we still have many products in our homes that we don't buy a new couch every year. So many products still contain these. Air pollution, I think people are aware of what that is. And we've particularly listed combustion-related air pollutants, from traffic, et cetera. Lead, I think everybody's pretty aware of lead.
And I think lead and mercury are things that have been covered, particularly pregnant women. Jennifer, I want to ask you about the pesticides that Sue brought up. You've done some specific research on that. We have some reports that you've done about pesticides that we'll tweet out if you follow 21st Show. People who work in fields, I think, Jennifer, obviously at the greatest risks of exposure, but are the levels of pesticide, Sue was mentioning them on fruit, is that something that people should be worried about consuming through eating food? Is washing the fruit not sufficient enough to get rid of pesticides?
So a lot of times you can actually get rid of it by washing. So washing is a really good thing to do. And frankly, we should wash all our fruits and vegetables, even ones we pick right out of our own garden, for lots of reasons, including just dirt and, you know, other things that can get on it. But in addition to washing, you could peel off the outer layers, for instance, of your leafy green vegetables. I always take away the first couple layers of a cabbage or a head of lettuce. For things like broccoli or cauliflower, you can break it up a little and then soak it in a bowl of water. So if the pesticide has gone inside the little cracks and crevices, you can wash it away that way. Peel it if it's an inedible peel. That always helps. And in addition, if we choose to buy organic, if we're able to do that, we could encourage a whole farming system that will use much, much less chemicals and certainly stay away from the most toxic, including the organophosphate pesticides. Do you mind if I comment on the nail polish?
Sure, go ahead.
And you know, your listeners, there's a great website. It's EWG Environmental Working Group. It's called Skin Deep, and it's a searchable database. And I do see that they have nails and nail polish on there, but lots of other cosmetics too. So it's a good place to look up and find some safer ones.
And I'm glad you said that. We just actually tweeted that out as well. So if you follow 21ST Show, 21st Show, you can see that. And thanks for that. So that's kind of a little bit about the pesticides. We had a question from Wendy on Facebook, Sue, about BPA, because I think that's a chemical that we've heard a lot about. And I think she said that I hear a lot about BPA and other harmful chemicals in plastic. It seems almost impossible to avoid plastic. How important is it, do you think, to try to avoid it? If I buy only BPA-free products, does that make it safe, or are there other chemicals I need to worry about in regards to plastics?
Boy, that's a big question, and it's it's one that many, many people are wondering about these days. So BPA or bisphenol A is used in certain types of plastics, the sort of hard, clear polycarbonate plastic, and it's also used to line metal food and drink cans. If you buy something that is BPA-free, that doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. There are replacements, such as BPF and BPS, that could be in some of these products, and they are chemicals of similar structure. We don't know as much about them yet, but they're likely to have some of the similar risks of BPA. But ways that you can avoid BPA are to try to use glass storage containers rather than plastic whenever you can, to eat a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables instead of canned foods, to eat fewer canned foods, and avoid drinking canned drinks. So there are ways that you can avoid exposure.
Jennifer, we also got a Facebook comment from Dina. She says she watched a documentary called Stink, and she learned that products that list fragrance as an ingredient won't tell you what chemicals are in the fragrance. And she said, I feel the public has a right to know what ingredients are in the product they're buying. Are there health concerns over the chemicals that are used in fragrances, Jennifer?
Yeah, definitely. And I was one of the many fantastic experts featured in that film, Stink. If people can find time and a place to see it, it's a fantastic movie, and it does focus on fragrances. So that's right. That is a real issue, because even the regulatory agencies don't know what's in the fragrances. A lot of times, even the manufacturer doesn't know what's in the fragrances. So this is really a trade secret, but we do know that they often include things like the phthalates, again, that carry the fragrance into the air. They're volatile chemicals, so we know they can be inhaled, and for the most part, they're unknown.
We just have a few minutes left. Susan, I wanted to ask you about a research study that you're leading at the U of I called iKids. You're in the process of recruiting several hundred pregnant women and studying how the chemicals they're exposed to affect their baby's development. Are you trying to answer some more of these questions, like what we've been talking about today?
Yes. I mean, for most of my career, I've been interested in how prenatal exposure to chemicals affects children's neurodevelopment. And the study we're doing, iKids, is looking at chemicals that are in consumer products. So phthalates that we've talked a lot about today are one of the ones we're focusing on, as is BPA. We're also looking at some of the replacements for BPA that I mentioned, and we're looking at parabens, which are used in a lot of personal care products as well, and triclosan, which is an antibacterial that is used in, or was used until recently, in a lot of liquid soaps.
So you said that as you're doing this research, the statement was based on existing research. You're saying that you and these and Jennifer and these other scientists are saying you want to have a call to action. What can consumers do now?
Be as informed as possible. Try to avoid exposure. Our actually Project Tender has created a website that has a lot of useful information for the public, explains the chemicals that we've selected as our examples, talks about how you're exposed and how you could avoid exposure. So taking some tips like that can help. And also getting involved and being active, as Jennifer said, and if the public has a strong demand for chemical-free products, then I think more will happen to create those.
Jennifer, we just have about 10 or 15 seconds left. Any final advice for people?
No, that was perfect. Susan was excellent. Demand of your products and the consumer line, write to your favorite product and tell them what you want, and support regulations and rules that help to make that possible.
That link to Project Tender is also on our website. I want to thank Sue Schantz from the University of Illinois, Jennifer Sass from the NRDC for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the Chicago Tribune broke the news that President Obama is soon to announce he's chosen Jackson Park as the location for his presidential library. The neighborhood is one of two on the city's south side that have been vying for the library. Blair Kamen is an architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune and one of the reporters who broke the story yesterday. He joins us by phone from the Tribune Tower newsroom. Blair, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Blair, you and I have been talking, it seems like for years, you and I have been having conversations about President Obama's library. There was some discussion. I feel like now we're finally here. We have an architect. We have a location. Let's talk about the location for a minute. There was some discussion that the president would choose Washington Park. What do you think was ultimately behind the decision for Jackson Park?
Honestly, I don't know. We know what the news was. We don't necessarily know why. You're asking the right question, though, and we can certainly speculate. The Jackson Park site is the more cautious and in some ways the more easy site to develop. And by that, I mean that it's near the Museum of Science and Industry. It's near the lakefront. So right there, you have a familiar path for tourists to make the pilgrimage to the Obama Library. In contrast, Washington Park was offering a site that was rougher, that was further west of the lakefront, and was closer to the Dan Ryan, and just in general, a less attractive site. On its face. So, I mean, it's quite possible that the, you know, developers often try to build strength from strength. And with Woodlawn, the neighborhood around Jackson Park, beginning to redevelop, with Hyde Park itself booming, and with what I mentioned before about the proximity of the lakefront and the Museum of Science and Industry, you could see where, the scale probably tipped toward Jackson rather than Washington.
Blair, for folks outside of Chicago who are not familiar with this part of the South Side, you've mm-hmm. located for everybody, right? Because you've given us a locator near the museum. You've said Woodlawn. What else about this location you think will be, what do you think will be important for people to know? What else can you tell us about the neighborhood? Because as you mentioned, Hyde Park has gone through, this is where the University of Chicago is, and also there's mm-hmm. been a pretty concerted effort to have some shopping centers and hotels. The University of Chicago has invested a lot in building up Hyde Park in a way that it hasn't been for years.
Right. I mean, the parks themselves are important. They're as important as what's around them. These parks, Washington, Jackson, and the thin strip of green, the Midway Plaisance that draws them together, were all designed by Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Vaux. These were great 19th century landscape designers. Their works include Central Park in New York City. So one of the big challenges going forward is how do you insert a museum in Jackson Park, one of these Olmsted and Vaux parks, without disrupting and scarring that landscape? How do you try to enhance the park rather than denigrate it? So I think this is really needs to be a prime focus of consideration. We're not just talking about the object, the building, but rather the setting that incorporates it. And that is really crucial going forward because, there's great value to these parks, and we shouldn't ignore that, you know, Obama's building them in a very sensitive spot. And it really challenges the architects, Todd Williams and Billy Tien, to come up with a solution that creates an attractive building but also respects the historic park landscape.
And that's their challenge. This would be a presidential library. What do we know about what the architects have been tasked with? Is it one building? Do we have a sense of what this presidential library location will look like?
We don't. We don't know exactly, but we do know from things that they've said in the past that they often like to break up what could be a large singular building into a smaller ensemble. And the idea is that it creates a place rather than a thing. The smaller pieces frame spaces, either within like a courtyard or in some kind of context with the surrounding landscape. These architects also are modernists. We are not going to see a traditionalist building like the Imperialist Nightmare or the Harold Washington Library Center. But nor are we going to see, they're not modernists in the vein of Frank Gehry, like a deconstructivist modernist. So we're not going to see something like Gehry's Stata Center at MIT, which has been compared to a bunch of drunken robots having a party. Williams and Tien are architects who are noted for their cool forms, their celebration of materials, and also very rich interior spaces, by which I mean that, the building isn't just the object that you see from the outside. It's rather a progression of spaces. So as Billy Tien has said, the building is a verb rather than a noun. You experience it as a progression rather than just one single image that you look at from afar. So I don't think they're likely to design like a building shaped like the letter O, a giant a giant circle. That would be a one-liner and probably not what they have in mind.
Blair, one quick last question for you. As you're saying this, it strikes me, I'm thinking about the architecture around that area, as you said, around the Museum of Science and Industry, University of Chicago, its varied architectural forms at the university. Is your sense that they will try to adhere more to the natural surroundings rather than the architectural flavor of what is existing on the South Side?
I think that's a great question. I mean, interestingly enough, Williams and Tien designed the Logan Center for the Arts at the University of Chicago, just south of the Midway Plaisance. And that's a building that has an 11-story tower that clearly is referencing the neo-Gothic towers of the University of Chicago. This site, though, which is to the east of the Logan Center, far to the east of it, is a very different context. It's in the middle of an Olmsted Park. A very tall tower probably would be inappropriate. Although, it's conceivable that Barack Obama is thinking about like an office on top of the tower, on top of the museum that and library that would have a nice view of Lake Michigan, particularly in the wintertime when the leaves drop and you can see through the, you know, the trees to the lake.
That would be a pretty great office.
It would be a pretty great office. And often, you know, that's what determines site selection rather than all the other factors that we've been talking about. We'll see. I mean, I think that this is going to be fascinating to see unfold. It's a site that, you know, the bar is high architecturally. At the same time, there has to be great respect for the landscape. And the third factor here really has to do with something we haven't talked about a lot, which is that, you know, this is going to be an unusual presidential library, and that's going to be located directly across the street from a poor, predominantly African-American neighborhood. That's not the typical MO for presidential libraries. I mean, typically they're in, you know, parks or grand settings. There's some of that here because Jackson Park has its roots, of course, in the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. It's a grand civic site, but I mean, it's a grand civic site that's next to a very poor neighborhood. So balancing all those things is going to be quite a challenge for the architects, and it's going to be fascinating to see going forward what they come up with.
Right, and we know certainly most of the folks in the neighborhood have been very excited about this because of the economic development that they see will come to the neighborhood. Do we have any expectation of when the official announcement will come, Blair?
Probably next week. That's what we think. I mean, just to underscore what you're saying about the neighborhood concerns. I mean, on the one hand, there's economic development. On the other hand, there's the social equity issue. We saw this flare up with the 606 trail. In other words, you had an amenity come in, but it sparked redevelopment, which was good. But that also raised rents, prices.
Right, and people saying gentrification, right? This trail that was meant to be this huge biking, walking trail then ended up people saying, hey, is this going to push us out of the neighborhood?
Exactly. And so, I mean, this is a very difficult tightrope walk for someone like Barack Obama, who began his career as a community organizer, right? I mean, how ironic it would be if his presidential library ignited, you know, a wave of gentrification.
He doesn't want that, right.
Blew people out of the neighborhood. So, I mean, again, that's part of the balancing act here. It's really a very three-dimensional game here, chess game. And, it's tough, you know, to balance all these things and to get it right. The clients, the Obamas and the architects, Williams and Tsien, really have their work cut out for them.
Blair Kamen is an architecture critic from the Chicago Tribune, joining us from their newsroom there. Thanks, Blair.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you. And thanks again for, your attention to this story.
Orland Park Police Chief Tim McCarthy is a former Secret Service agent who was one of the men shot by would-be presidential assassin John Hinckley Jr. in 1981. McCarthy, who was just named State Police's Chief of the Year, joins us now to share his reaction to the news announced yesterday that Hinckley will soon be released from a government psychiatric hospital more than 35 years after he attempted the assassination. Chief McCarthy, thank you for taking time to be with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you.
What was your first reaction yesterday, Chief, when you heard the news that John Hinckley Jr. was going to be released?
Well, I wasn't surprised. I mean, over the years, over the past 20 years, Hinckley has been released from time to time on different supervised releases to live with his parents and to do other things. So I wasn't surprised that at some point he received a full and final release, so to speak, though I know there's conditions and I know he can be brought back if he violates them. But I wasn't altogether shocked about it.
I mean, how do you feel about the decision? Are you concerned that he still poses a danger to himself or others?
Well, the judge says no. However, we also know that medicine, and in particular psychiatry, is not an exact science. He's been in a clinical setting for these past 35 years, and now he's going to be out in the real world. And from what I have read, none of the conditions on there, I don't know what the Secret Service is going to do as far as surveilling him and things of that nature, but there's nothing there that prevents him from, you know, potentially violating any of those things other than a threat to go back to St. Elizabeth's Hospital. As I've said, they would call me all the time. Many years ago, I asked him to stop calling, let me know he was going to be released. I hope they're right. If he's totally cured and if they can guarantee that, so be it. However, let's keep in mind that he killed a man. He almost killed the President of the United States and wounded two others. And now I understand he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, so we're looking at a different standard here. But had it been otherwise, I don't think he would be on the street.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you're referring to, of course, Jim Brady, who was paralyzed by and then just died a few years ago. You know, I wanted to ask you, Chief, in the past, you've shared that as a Secret Service agent, you never think about getting hurt. And I think for those of us who've never done a job like yours, that seems really hard to understand. And I wonder if you can describe the mindset it takes to be a Secret Service agent and to be willing to step in front of a bullet like you did that day.
Well, it's no different whether it's a police officer, a member of the military, Secret Service, even a firefighter. You're trained well, you're equipped well. Psychologically, you're prepared for combat, so to speak, or for one of these things. But I'll tell you, every policeman, fireman, member of the military never thinks it's going to happen to them. It's always going to happen to someone else. So, you know, my father was a sergeant in the Chicago Police Department, and many of my friends growing up went into law enforcement. So while you never consciously think about it, you know it could happen, but you certainly don't dwell on it. And there's many jobs that have high risk. Reporters, I mean, there's reporters in war zones and in unsafe neighborhoods all the time. So you think about it, but certainly it's in the back of your mind, but you're counting on your training, you're counting on your equipment and your experience that hopefully it's not going to happen to you. But it is the nature of the beast at being first responders that something could happen. And it's probably more how you respond after something happens that's as important as preparing for it.
Well, and as I think about you saying responding after something happens, you have such distance on this. This was decades ago. Do you still think very much about that day and the aftermath of it?
Not a great deal. You know, it comes up time from time, such as occasions.
When reporters
like
call you.
Yeah, exactly.
When we call you to talk about it, right?
You bet. And different anniversaries and different dates that come up relating to it. But I don't think about it too much. I mean, it certainly changed my life. I mean, I'd be foolish to say that, you know, when you're involved in something like this, that it didn't change my life. It certainly did. It's something that you don't look forward to do, and you certainly can't prepare for it, and you hope you cope with it well afterwards. And, you know, President Reagan, you know, he was, of course, he was almost killed, as the record shows. And, you know, he bounced back from it very quickly, a great attitude. He was a great example for me, you know, that, you know, there's a psychology of, you know, people injured or go through a critical incident as to how well they return to what they were doing before. And, you know, I was very motivated to go back, you know, on the presidential detail and finish my career in the Secret Service. And the president was certainly a great example. You know, he bounced back pretty quickly and not only completed his first term, but completed a second term as well and had many, many great accomplishments. So it was important for me, you know, to go back to what I was doing and complete my career. And at this point, I'm still in law enforcement.
Well, I was going to say, you're still working. It's certainly a unique perspective. You know, we just have less than a minute left, Chief, but I wonder what advice you give to your officers that serve with you today that this experience has sort of informed for you.
Well, you have to take your training seriously. And every single day you have to take your training seriously and do it right every time how you do things. But this is a job where, whether it's Secret Service or police, have to make decisions in an instant. So they have to be instinctual. They have to be based upon training and based upon experience. So it's a tough profession. We can only hope that when we are in one of these crises, that we're able to do what we were trained to do.
Thanks for that, Chief. Yep, thank you so much. Orland Park Police Chief Tim McCarty, thanks for being with us.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's always one or two homes in the neighborhood with that perfect lawn. It's green. There's no weeds. There's crisscrossing tracks from the lawnmower. We have a lot tied up in our lawns in this country, but that wasn't always the case. Illinois is called the Prairie State for a reason. At one point, two-thirds of our land was covered with prairie grasses and flowers, and there's an effort underway to bring some of that back in your front yard. We've got two guests who have been working on this who are joining us now. Nathan Auberg is the program director with the Liberty Prairie Foundation in Lake County in northern Illinois. It's an area that has about 5,000 acres of open land and includes the Prairie Crossing Conservation Community. Hi, Nathan. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by Cody Considine. He's a restoration ecologist at the Nature Conservancy's Natusa Grasslands. That's about 100 miles west of Chicago. Cody, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you. Happy to be on the air.
Nathan, I wanted to start with a simple question. Why are lawns so important to us? It seems like such an American thing to take pride in your lawn.
Well, I think it's a combination of the development of technology over time, as well as cultural history. I think we've long looked at Europe and England for our sort of norms for what cultural sophistication is. And so England has long had a tradition of, you know, the open, close-cropped lawns, and I think that's conveyed sophistication to us. And I think after World War II, there was an increased emphasis on conformity, I think, somewhat in American culture. I think there was the scare about communism, and so there's also development of suburbs that really use the lawn as a connecting element. So you put together that cultural history with herbicides that came out of World War II industry, and you've got the potential to sort of really create a norm for what landscapes should look like. And so we know, for example, very quickly, there's a great book called Lawn People by Paul Robbins, which really looked at why we are defined by our lawns. And he did a survey, and one of the common findings they found was that people said, you know what's going on inside a house by what you see outside the house. And so that kind of tells us we expect if the lawn is sort of orderly and well taken care of, that says that family is living well and is a good family.
Okay, so I wonder what people say then when they see a lawn that's full of prairie grass, which is not orderly and well kept, right? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about, Nathan, the Prairie Crossing Conservation Community and how many of those lawns have a front of prairie grass versus the kind of typical American lawn that we are used to and what you've just been describing.
Well, let me just set the context for that. Prairie Crossing was developed really for two reasons. One was to try to preserve as much open space in this particular area as possible and connect it with trail systems and that kind of thing. And I think the other concept was let's try to reinvent or create a new model for what the suburban development would actually look like in terms of its relationship with nature. And so we have approximately 677 acres. About a little over 60% of that is in open space, which is pretty remarkable. Most subdivisions are mostly homes. We have over 150 acres of prairie. We have wetlands. We have lakes. So the open space, the common open space, is one of the defining features of Prairie Crossing. So that kind of creates the tone. It sets the tone for everything else. As far as the 359 homes in Prairie Crossing, I would say the majority of them use some prairie plants someplace. Not all of them use it a lot, but many of them do. And it creates a real eclectic atmosphere. The trick is, I think, for a lot of Americans, we sometimes don't know what a prairie plant is from a weed.
Right.
And you drive into Prairie Crossing, and people, if you don't know your prairie plants, you say, boy, that looks like a mess. But if you know your prairie plants, you'll say, that's a really amazing, diverse landscape that's great for birds, butterflies, insects, and the whole web of life.
Cody, how can we know our prairie plants? Can you help us a little bit more so we can become better informed about that?
That's a good question. We often get asked that question by our neighbors and people in our community. Folks driving by may seem to think that all the our prairie plants are weeds, and maybe depending on what their background is, they may consider them weeds. But there's really, I mean, most prairie plants, for instance, in Illinois, there's hundreds and hundreds of different species. So there's really no one distinguishable characteristic that would, you know, relate to make it a prairie plant or not. So it's just kind of knowing, having the knowledge to be able to identify that. And, you know, I would recommend picking up a field guide or just doing a little bit of research on the web and go that route.
We're tweeting out some photos of the Prairie Crossing Conservation Community by the well. If you follow 21st Show, you can see that there. Nathan, I wonder if you can describe for us that open space that you were talking about. What does that look like?
Well, that's a great question. I think photos would do it better than words, although I like to think of myself as somewhat good with words. But there's some really nice long views. I guess that would be the best way to put it. You can look out from most homes. Almost every home in Prairie Crossing looks out in some sort of open space. And so there's a combination of lakes. There's a few hedgerows that have been kept from the original farm. And so you see, depending on the season, a different mix of flowers, often a lot of yellows and blues. You will see wetlands with a different kind of set of vegetation. And it's just like a big sky. It's not quite as big sky as the West might be, but it just sort of opens your spirit. It's really, it just feels different being there than any other place.
Cody, what about Natchesa grasslands? Is it a similar field to what Nathan's describing?
Very much so. So we're a large-scale prairie restoration project in the state. We're about 4,000 acres, and we've been restoring this landscape since 1986. And recently, in the last 2 years, we've introduced the large herbivore native to the state, the bison. And so we're trying to put all the pieces back together. And it's pretty much an open landscape, and it really kind of takes you back in time to see what Illinois used to look like.
When you make it, sometimes people make a distinction between native plants and prairie plants. Can one of you explain, Cody, can you explain what's the difference?
So native plants, I guess, and, you know, it all depends on the question that they're referring to, because most of our prairie plants are native plants. Now, if you go the different regions of the state, you may have certain plants that are native to that particular locale. So it's a term we call a local ecotype. For instance, when we do restorations in Natchesa, we collect seed close to Natchesa geographically. We don't like to go too far away with the thought of potentially bringing in something that may harm the native plants that we have here on site.
And what goes into the restoration that you guys are doing as you're talking about seeds? Because it's not really just throwing down seeds, is it?
Sure, no. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of hard work. We are collecting seeds from May to the end of November, hand harvesting seeds, sometimes up to 250 different species. Our crews are averaging about 4,000 pounds of seed by hand. So it's a lot of work. A lot of running around, getting seeds, knowing when they're ready, being able to identify them when they are ready. And then when the corn or soybeans comes out of production and we determine that field needs to be retired and go back in the prairie, then essentially we mix them up depending on the habitat and the soil type, and then we spread the seed on the soil and drag it in. And then the next few years is a lot of weed management and then ultimately fire over time.
Nathan, would you say that native plants require less or more, about the same amount of upkeep once they've taken seed?
Well, I guess, Cody, you'd probably be in a better situation to answer that, but I would say you have to be really patient for the first 3-5 years. I think grass, you have your typical lawn, you get immediate response, and you're up and running. I think most native plants, especially prairie plants, put a lot of energy in the first 2 to 3 to 5 years into the root systems, and then they start showing themselves. And I think our American culture, sometimes we want immediate results, and prairie plants require a different kind of thinking and patience.
Well, you know, and it's, you used to talk about that, Nathan, about our American culture. I think certainly we started this conversation talking about lawns and the place that they've sort of come in American society. And I think certainly over the past couple of years, when we're looking at the water conditions that we've been facing, both when we went through the drought here in Illinois, kind of the chronic conditions they face in California, do you think that people are more open now to thinking about lawns that require less water? Is it, are you all seeing, and Nathan, you can start, and Cody, you can answer as well, more interest in the notion of something like prairie grass?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a greater interest. I know in Las Vegas and Los Angeles, there's a lot of proactive municipal programs to encourage people to remove lawn. I think we're entering, an age, hopefully, of desiring to have more of a give-and-take relationship with nature. When you think of a lot of our relationships, whether it's with our spouse, with our parents, with our kids, we have a mutual partnership, and for a long time, I'm afraid to say our relationship with nature has been pretty domineering. And so I think there is a desire to have a different relationship. It's just challenging because you have to do a lot of learning. And I think that's one of the appeals of it. But you have to do a lot of learning to really get that prairie going or use those native plants well.
And how do you guys suggest people start? Because it does sound like it's a lot of learning. I imagine if you're a homeowner at Prairie Crossing, it's probably a lot easier to do this. But if you're not in those communities, Nathan, how do you think where should you start? Because as you said, some people just have certain prairie grass or flowers that they're trying to plant at certain parts of their yard.
Well, I would start with looking for local nonprofits, land trusts, and other organizations that know the local ecosystems. Nature Conservancy is a great resource as well. If you go online, there's just a growing number of native plant nurseries that also can share advice. I think as soon as you start reaching out, you'll find resources. I know there's a group called Wild Ones, which is a national group that tries to help and support people do this. So it's not as hard as it sounds to find that network of people who can support you.
Cody, what other advice would you offer?
I think Nathan said it very well, but maybe the one main thing is patience. If you are going to do a native planting from seed, you know, realize that it is going to take some time to see results. If you want to speed up the process, you can buy prairie plugs. That's basically the plant is a one-year-old, and then you can have more of the immediate gratification of seeing that prairie.
For both of you, as you're talking about the patience, a lot of that is, as you said, sort of the root system and having those roots develop. We were looking at some pictures. We tweeted some out earlier of the root system. You can see how intricate they are. They're really deep. They're really long. That also leads to, I think, some environmental benefits. I wanted to ask you about why prairie grasses and wildflowers are good for preventing flooding after a heavy rain. Cody?
Well, it really comes down to the roots. When you look at those roots, you know, some of them are very extensive. They hold the soil together. So if you're speaking of a flood, a high water event, you know, that prairie is going to hold that soil together and prevent cutting and erosion and so forth. And I guess I would just add that, comparing, prairie plants to lawn grass, the lawn grass is very shallow roots. Where the prairie plants are very extensive, they're storing a lot of carbon. So just like trees, they're taking a lot of pollutants out of the air and storing carbon in ground. So they are very beneficial plants for us.
What kind of winter care do they require, Cody?
Not much. In our landscape, we burn in the fall and early spring. If it's a homeowner, they could clip the plants down to the ground level, rake the bed thatch away. If they have a little larger plot and it's acceptable where they live, fire is beneficial to the prairie. Or if they can't burn, the mowing is also a good strategy to kind of invigorate that growth.
One last quick question for you, Nathan. Do you all have, you were talking about the restored prairies and wetlands, do you have lawn areas for things like get-togethers or sports in your community?
That's a great question. We certainly don't advocate that everyone remove every single square inch of lawn. Lawn is a great thing for playing sports and that kind of thing. So we do have some recreational areas for playing soccer, parks, and that kind of thing. And so that's definitely a part of our of our landscape.
Thanks for joining us. Nathan Auberg is the Program Director for Food, Farms, and the Environment at the Liberty Prairie Foundation up in Lake County in northern Illinois, and he's been talking to us about the Prairie Crossing community. I want to thank also Cody Considine, who's a restoration ecologist with the Nature Conservancy's Natusa Grasslands. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're continuing our summer book series. The book list we're compiling for you tomorrow is around politics and political books. Chicago Magazine's Carol Felsenthal will be joining us along with librarians from the Champaign Public Library. If you have suggestions of your favorite political book, fiction or nonfiction, you can email us to books@21stshow.org and tune in tomorrow. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.